and business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Our admonish to draw near and give your attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3807-AL. United States of America, appellate, Mr. Jamal Keeler. Presiding, the attorney.
Good morning. Suzanne Nyland for the United States. The parties, I think, at this point are agreed that Dillon controls most of the reason why, that in fact the entire reason that the district court below, we say, erred in reducing the appellee's sentences beyond the lower end of the amended guidelines range. That is to say, the policy statement governing sentencing modification was treated as advisory when in fact it is binding on the district courts. And so we asked for the case to be sent back for resentencing consistent with Dillon. But we wanted to address the notice and comment alternative argument that the appellant has raised, which appellees say is an alternative basis for upholding the district court. First, that argument, in our view, is waived because it wasn't raised in the district court.
When would they have raised it in the posture of this case? They won below.
They did.
Yeah, so they had neither reason nor apparently occasion to have raised that argument, did they?
I would argue they did, because they could have gone in this way. Number one, the argument they did make, the policy statement's not binding, it's merely advisory. Number two, if you think it is binding, then you shouldn't apply it. You should apply the previous version, because this version, we contend, didn't go through notice and comment procedure.
But the district court had already held this before, right?
Pardon me?
The district court in another case had already.
Yes, that's true.
So it's hardly necessary to give an alternative argument for an argument you've already won in another case.
Well, but in the Marymount Hospital case, this court was confronted with a similar alternative basis proposed by the hospital at that point, challenging its Medicare reimbursement from HHS. And for the first time on appeal, in addition to challenging the agency action as arbitrary and capricious, an argument like this was raised.
How did they come out below in that one? Had they won below?
No, they had lost below.
All right, so it was not at all the same posture, 180-degree different posture, right?
That is true, but there's another problem with not treating it as waived here, and that is that the court, as a result of this, doesn't have a full administrative record. Sometimes, as was said in the National Mining Association case, the court will look at the comments that come in response to a Federal Register notice, and the court doesn't really have those.
That would apply to your backup argument that even if notice were required, there was enough notice here, right? That wouldn't apply to the first question, the legal question of whether notice is required. Right? Legal question.
A purely legal question, but the court apparently, and stated in National Mining Association, at times will look at the comments. We, of course, have argued you don't need to
look
at all here.
Soft by remanding, if the extent one gets into that.
It could be, but it shouldn't be, because this should have been raised below. And as Judge Garland has pointed out, really legally, you don't need to reach that point. I'm simply noting.
You have not yet told me when exactly or why they would have raised below a ground different than the one they won on when they won on the one that they won on. And it had previously been so ruled by the same judge. You gave me a case in which the party had lost below and they were deemed to have waived a ground. And that's standard. We know that. That's no problem. But do you have a case in which a party who won on a ground that they're evidently going to win on is said to have waived another basis for victory by not raising it below?
No, I don't. But I also don't have
a case. In fact, we have cases that say we can affirm a district court on any basis, don't we?
That's true, but generally speaking, you don't have an argument like this for which there's either no legal and no factual record backing up the argument that's being presented here for the first time.
Well, the first step of the argument, you don't need a factual record on, do you? The first step is it required?
That's
is notice and comment required on this?
That's correct. And moving to the merits, we would argue, getting past waiver, that 994X applies only, the notice and comment requirements apply only to guidelines and not to a policy statement.
The immediate issue as to whether the existence of the policy statement, the relatively recent policy statement, is in any way necessary to the outcome. I mean, on that issue, you have Dillon's footnote number one on your side, saying essentially that it's not meaningfully different from the version in effect at the time of the district court's decision, which I assume earlier than the district court's decision here.
Then that is helpful, and that goes both to the notice point and the point that giving them the relief they're requesting doesn't change anything.
Wait. In what way is footnote number one helpful to you?
Footnote number one is helpful because essentially what it's suggesting is that the old version of 1B1.10 wasn't, that margin was not markedly different from the version we have today.
Better look more closely at footnote number one. Footnote number one is about the difference between the revision in March of 2008 and the version of the guidelines, which was in effect when the Supreme Court issued its opinion in June of 2010. Between those two, there was no change.
Okay,
But the guideline that you're talking about is different. At least the policy statement is different. Now, there is commentary that may be similar, but that's not addressed in footnote one, is it?
Then it wouldn't be. That's correct. I apologize for confusing that. But I still would maintain that the old version we're speaking about here that was in effect before the one that was applied by the district court here, the March 2008 one, are, for all purposes, for most intents and purposes, basically the same, because the Eighth Circuit, sitting on Bank and Hassan, read 1B1.10, the old version, to limit the power and sentence modification of
the guideline. I mean, the policy statement itself, you have to admit, is considerably different. Wouldn't you agree? It says the court should consider the term of imprisonment. The new one says that the court cannot go below.
That is true, but the Supreme Court said in Stinson that application notes are also to be considered authoritative in reading policy statements and guidelines. And the application notes state that in the old version that the amended guideline range limits the extent to which an eligible defendant's sentence may be reduced. That was in application note 3. Admittedly, it's clearer in the actual policy statement itself post-March 2008. But it's not the case that it was a major change if one reads the application notes as being binding, because this concept that the district court was limited in how much it could do on sentence modification was incorporated into the application notes, and that was recognized by the court.
I think you may be right, but it seems like a harder question. Stinson is specifically talking about commentary that interprets a guideline, not commentary that interprets a policy statement.
Actually, Stinson is speaking to commentary in the guidelines manual. And the policy statements are included
that interprets,
in the guidelines manual.
Yes, but it's commentary. I mean, Stinson has a discussion about policy statements, and it has a discussion about guidelines, and it has a discussion about commentary. And at page 45, it talks about this type of commentary, that is, type of commentary that interprets a guideline is akin to an agency's interpretation of its own legislative rules. I'm not saying that that couldn't extend as well to interpretation of a policy statement, but that would be a step beyond Stinson, that's all.
Well, I would read Stinson differently because it speaks to commentary in the guidelines manual being authoritative, but I grant you that, of course, because we've made this argument, guidelines and policy statements are different in terms of the notice and comment requirements. In any event, there was adequate notice given.
Your strongest argument, Ben?
The strongest argument beyond waiver would be that 994X applies only to guidelines and not to policy statements. And that's pretty clear from the Sentencing Reform Act itself, which defines guidelines and policy statements separately, which mentions guidelines in terms of notice and comment requirements, but not policy statements, which includes in the policy statement definition a reference to sentencing modification, the statute. And of course, the sentencing modification statute cross-references commission policy statements. That's a pretty good tracking mechanism that tells us that Congress didn't intend for notice and comment to apply to policy statements. And that, I would guess, putting it forward, would be my strongest argument. Failing that, even, we also have an additional argument that there was notice given here, because the Federal Register notice was published. It, based on the old guideline, which had some commentary in the application notes of how this would work in the district court, that would have given adequate notice to those reading this notification of what the issue was. And so even though they weren't required to do it, the commission did ask for comment, did receive it, and the notice was adequate as a logical outgrowth of the old policy statement.
It didn't announce this specific policy statement that is one with a binding
It didn't publish the actual policy statement that was adopted, but the court has never held that that isn't necessarily required. what the court says is the notice is adequate if what comes out of the process is a logical outgrowth of what went into the notice. And we would maintain that that was true here because of the strong connection at a minimum of the old version of 1B1.10 and the one that was adopted. And so for those reasons, we would ask that the case be sent back to the district court, and I'll save the remainder of my time for any rebuttal, for resentencing consistent with Dillon. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee. I don't recall ever hearing from you as appellee.
No, I don't recall ever being appellee. It's a nice position to be in.
Did you find it hard to sit at the correct table?
I do like being over there. May it please the court, Mary Petras on behalf of Jamal Wheeler and Gary Williams. Let me just start with what the government says is its strongest argument, because I would urge the court to take a look at the statute and the language within it. The government points to 28 U.S.C. 994X for the proposition that the notice and comment provision of the APA only applies to guidelines. And then, as the government does point out, Section A of 994 does distinguish between guidelines and policy statements. And then the government argues from that when the statute refers in X to guidelines, it refers only to guidelines referred to in A1. But if you look at the statute, that is clearly not the case. In every subsection within 994 where Congress intended to refer only to guidelines as it's used in subsection A1, it says, for example, if you look at subsection F, it says the commission in promulgating guidelines pursuant to subsection A1. And it does that in a couple of different provisions. It does it in F, it does it in E, it does it in L. And then if you compare that with the use of the term guidelines in J, subsections J, K, and N, you'll see that the qualifier as used in subsection A1 is not in there. So clearly Congress knew how to distinguish between its reference to guidelines and the Sentencing Commission exercising its rulemaking authority and referring to guidelines as distinguished from policy statements. So the statute itself does not support the government's argument given those distinctions. Really, what Section 994X refers to is the Commission's rulemaking authority. So the question here is no different than it is in any other APA case, is whether or not this was an exercise of the Commission's rulemaking authority, whether or not they issued a substantive rule versus interpretive commentary. And here, it clearly was a substantive rule.
Has the Commission ever sent out policy statements for notice and comment? Is this an aberrant thing that they didn't send it out this time? Or is this their common practice, their usual practice?
I'm not an expert in this area. I believe that, I don't think this is their common practice. Because I think that
isn't that germane? If we're making a determination as to whether they intended to do a substantive rulemaking or not, isn't the Commission's interpretation germane to us answering that question? I'm not sure if it's literally Chevron, but it certainly would seem to approach Chevron.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You don't work in APA. Do you know what Chevron is?
I do know what Chevron is. Yes,
well, if they're treating it as the meaning of that statute, that this is not something they have to send out for notice and comment. And the statute, I think you have to agree, does have ambiguity. Just a question of whether we're going to resolve it or the Commission did. And they have traditionally and by long practice treated it as if the use of the term guideline in the section requiring notice and comment does not include policy statements. Isn't that a fairly strong argument that we should adopt that interpretation of the statute differentially?
I do think that the court can look at how the agency refers to it, but the ultimate question is whether or not this is an exercise of the court's, of the Commission's rulemaking authority. So if the statute, I think, is actually fair, is clear that it, when the Commission is exercising its rulemaking authority, it does have to follow the notice and comment provision. And actually, the one case that the court, that the government cited for the support that it doesn't have to with regard to policy statements is, it had to do with an application note interpreting it. And when this court interpreted when this court decided Lopez, Lopez was actually had to do with a policy statement. And the court didn't say that the notice and comment provision doesn't apply. Now, the issue wasn't raised by the government exactly as it is here, but the challenge in Lopez was over Section 5H1.1, which is a policy statement, or called a policy statement. And the court noted only that just the notice and comment provision had to be followed and not other provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act, which is clear from Section 994. I'd also note that in Minstretta, when the Supreme Court rejected the separation of powers challenges to the Sentencing Commission's authority, the court noted that and used the term that the Commission is fully accountable to, it noted that the Commission is fully accountable to Congress and its rulemaking power is subject to the notice and comment requirements of the APA. So again, it comes down to whether or not this is an exercise.
Whether this is rulemaking or not.
Yes.
Whether it's legislative rulemaking.
Legislative rulemaking or interpretive rulemaking.
Correct. And this.
What makes it legislative in your view?
What makes it legislative is it's exercising its authority to set out a hard and fast rule that the district courts could not go below the amended range.
I mean, interpretations can be pretty hard and fast. I mean, the point really there is that they have their relationship to the either legislative rule that they're interpreting or the statute they're interpreting is such that they simply represent an interpretation, to use the adjective in the APA, of it, as opposed to, and the distinctions get murky, it's perfectly clear, but as opposed to creation of a new rule that an adjudicator would not arrive at from the legislative rule being interpreted.
Correct. And the question is not whether or not the Commission was interpreting its authority under 3582, but whether or not it was interpreting some rule it had already set forth. So our position is that...
Well, either way.
Yeah.
Well, there is a distinction because the question is the Commission setting forth a new rule as to how the district courts are to exercise its 3582 authority, or is the Commission interpreting a rule that the Commission already put forth as to how the district courts should exercise its 3582?
Well, why does that make a difference?
It makes a difference because the Sentencing Commission's has to abide by the APA when it issues rules, not when it interprets
legislative
rules, but not when it interprets its own rules. So here, this was a new rule.
Or when it interprets legislation, at least under the APA. If you're invoking the APA, it governs interpretations of statutes, as long as it's not a legislative interpretation of the statute.
But 3582, according to Dillon, gives the Sentencing Commission the authority to direct when the district courts can and cannot reduce sentences and what those rules are. So here, the Sentencing Commission was not interpreting what 3582 means. It was setting forth the rules under which the authority of 3582 could be exercised. It's not the same thing as looking at a statute and saying, well, the Sentencing Commission believes that the statute means this.
What about the proposition that before the earliest interpretation by the Commission, the Eighth Circuit had arrived at the same conclusion, same outcome as Dillon? In other words, it interpreted 3582 in exactly the same way that the Sentencing Commission did.
My understanding, at least... and I think there was a letter from the Judicial Conference, the Committee on Criminal Law, to the Commission that it actually indicated that up until that point, the only courts that had decided it had interpreted it the other way. But I don't think
that can be true. Hicks is the only.
Hicks was only the only case that had been decided at the time by a circuit as to whether or not Booker would apply. But it's not the same issue as whether or not the guideline prohibited it. The Hicks Court did address that issue, but most of the challenges were to whether or not Booker would mandate the district courts had the authority to go below the guidelines in a resentencing proceeding, but it didn't discuss, and in Hicks, the government alternatively said, well, the 1B1.1 says you can't go below, and the Ninth Circuit rejected that and said it doesn't, because clearly the language says that you should consider the amended guideline. And I should also point out that the government leaves out, when it quotes that old rule, the application note itself, because what the application note says in full is that under subsection B, the amended guideline range and the term of imprisonment already served by the defendant limit the extent to which an eligible defendant may be reduced, eligible sentence may be reduced. So it was referring to the guideline range, because the guideline range would give the court the authority to go to reduce the sentence. And the only thing that the guideline prohibited the court from going below was time served. So it was clear that this, the rule that was subsequently issued, was a change, because it then said you cannot go below the amended range.
If you read the limitation in the guideline as exclusive, right?
Well, if you read the language of the guideline and it's
as exclusive.
But the language of the guideline.
In other words, you can have a floor, a stated floor, but that does not preclude the existence of other floors, which are derived from the logic of the situation.
It doesn't preclude the commission from saying that there's a floor.
It doesn't preclude a court from interpreting the statute as having such a floor.
Correct, but the language of the statute didn't say that there
and
was
indeed,
a floor.
And indeed, if we're talking about the interpretation by the commission, we are talking about what sounds like an interpretive rule.
If the court is referring to the court changing 1B, or the Sentencing Commission changing 1B1.10 from the old version, it clearly felt like it needed to change the rule to make the rule hard and fast that you can't go below, rather than just recommending just saying that the court should consider the amended guideline range, which is all the old rule said.
But there is the background commentary that says that it's limited.
But it doesn't say that. It says that it's the court's authority is essentially is limited by time. It's limited by the guideline range and by time served, which is discussing subsection B of the guideline itself, which says that you have the authority if your guideline is changed.
It says limit the extent to which an eligible defendant's sentence may be reduced under C2. What
right,
does that
because
mean?
You can't be reduced unless the amended guideline changes your guideline range, and it can't be reduced below time served.
Well, that's one interpretation of it, I guess.
I understand, but the Ninth Circuit clearly said that as well. And,
well, they
and
did,
the
but
issue then is
the Supreme Court wasn't very impressed with their the other part of that opinion.
I understand.
You're talking about Hicks, right?
I understand that, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But if the issue is whether or not the Sentencing Commission was issuing a new rule when it amended 1B1.10, clearly it was, in the sense that it changed it so dramatically by changing it from this, at least vague language, and in our view was clear that it didn't prohibit it, but if you can interpret it other ways, the commission clearly knew that it had to put a hard and fast rule that you can't go below the amended range if that's what it wanted to do.
Well, maybe
and
they
the
wanted
problem
to
is,
clarify that Hicks was wrong.
Except that it changed the language so dramatically that
to make sure that the Ninth Circuit couldn't say that again.
To make sure that the rule that there was a new rule that
there's
says
another
you can't
element
go below.
of the rule. I mean, of the whole thing that is calling it resentencing for the same reason, right? That it's not just reset. I think Hicks said that this is. I'm trying to remember what the language is. Well, I've forgotten. So.
Oh, Hicks said that it was.
Another form of sentencing or something like that. Yeah.
But I don't think that even if the commission was, the commission still is changing the rules. The commission still is setting forth a new guideline, even though it's called it a policy statement. It is new rules that restrict whether or not the district court could amend it. And it is something that was a surprise to the defense bar, which is clear from the transcript of the hearing held on this, because the defense bar didn't come in and say you shouldn't do a binding rule that says you can't go below. Everybody knew that there was going to be this issue of Booker out there about whether or not you could argue this, but the commission never noticed put the defense bar on notice that it was going to do a binding rule and resolve the issue itself. Had it done so, then the defense bar would have brought in evidence to support the fact that that wasn't necessary, that the reasons that the court was considering, or that the commission was apparently considering doing that, wouldn't pan out and that it wasn't.
Can I ask you about your interpretation of the statute? Because this is sort of where this all begins. So I understand what you're saying about references to the guidelines in A1, but there, in almost, in many of the provisions, the statute, I'm talking about 994, begins with A1 describing what a guideline is, A2 describing what a policy statement is, and then in quite a number of the following ones where they want it to apply to both, they say the guidelines and policy statements, right? They say that in C, D, E. In all of those, they say both. If they wanted to take the position that you're taking, why didn't they say in X, promulgation of guidelines and policy statements?
But if they wanted to take the position that the government's taking, then why didn't they say guidelines pursuant to A1, which they did?
Because, well, I guess it's a question of which seems more. I mean, I understand your argument, but I think that when they use guidelines one way and they have a specific definition of each, and then when they have a number of places where they say guidelines or guidelines and policy statements, it seems like, I mean, all we can do is do the better reading here. That's the best we can do. We also have, of course, the Sentencing Commission saying its view that it doesn't have to issue policy statements under notice and comment.
But you also have the Supreme Court saying that when it issues its rulemaking authority, it has to abide by the administrative.
That's a given. We know that rulemaking authority has notice and comment. What we don't know is whether that applies to the policy statements in this case. And the question that Judge Garland's asking is, since Congress repeatedly said guidelines and policy statements when they meant both, and they only said guidelines in this section, why isn't it a reasonable interpretation, or maybe the best interpretation, to say that when they say guidelines, they mean guidelines. When they say guidelines and policy statements, they mean guidelines and policy statements.
Because they also repeatedly, when they wanted to only refer to guidelines as it's used in subsection A, said guidelines pursuant to subsection A.
We don't know whether that's because they wanted it only to do that, or they wanted it to be, to make a, you know, a belts and suspenders explanation of where the definition of guidelines are.
But that's not how we interpret statutes. You use the language that's used in the statute.
Yeah, and that's what your problem is. They use guidelines repeatedly, and then down here, guidelines and policy statements when they mean both. Down here, they just say guidelines.
But you're ignoring the fact that they also repeatedly use
guidelines. I'm not ignoring it.
But I'm finding
it to be of less importance than the fact that they say guidelines down here, not guidelines and policy statements.
I think the better reading of it is that the Congress intended for the Administrative Procedures Act to apply, and I know that the question is rulemaking authority, but it meant for rulemaking authority to be the same as it always is under the Administrative Procedure Act, the same.
Is that what they said? Is that what Congress said?
I think that's the clearest reading of the statute. When they mean to use guidelines only as it's used under Section A1, they say that, and they didn't say that in X.
Which of the provisions, F and what else, where they use A1?
It uses it in F, it uses it in L, it uses it in G.
Now, in F, it's actually a verbal use, where it's a verb use, where it's in promulgating guidelines pursuant to subsection A1. It doesn't say guidelines that are promulgated. It says in promulgating guidelines pursuant to the subsection. The phrase is modifying the verb. It's an adverbial phrase modifying the verb promulgating rather than modifying guidelines. I don't think F works to your advantage.
I think if you look at, if you compare.
I'm looking at F.
If you compare it to N, in N it says the commission shall assure that the guidelines reflect, and it doesn't say guidelines in A pursuant to A1. And then it refers to substantial assistance. And what's interesting is the commission
Doesn't N count rather strongly against you?
No, because
it doesn't say anything there about promulgated pursuant to the guidelines. It doesn't say promulgated pursuant to A1.
No, it just as it does in X, it refers only to guidelines. And then when the commission fulfills N and issues a guideline, it issues a policy statement on substantial assistance, 5K1.1. It doesn't issue a guideline, which clearly it thought it could do because it didn't have to do it in an A1 guideline rather than a policy statement, because in N it only refers to guidelines.
Both F and G do not support your proposition for which you're offering them, because in each of those the phrase that refers back to A1 is adverbial and describing or modifying the verb promulgating rather than modifying the noun guideline.
I don't think
they can be asked one way or the other.
But if it wanted to limit X, the application of the Administrative Procedures Act, only to guidelines, then it just as easily could have modified promulgation in X with pursuant to A1, but it didn't.
What do you think is the explanation for why sometimes they use guidelines or policy statements rather than guidelines under A1 or policy statements?
I think that sometimes they wanted to be clear that it was both, and sometimes they wanted to be clear that it was just A1, and sometimes they used a general term, guidelines, as we all use a general term, guidelines. And the clearest interpretation of X is to look at the general rulemaking power and whether or not this is an exercise of rulemaking power, not whether or not
X
the commission calls it a
promulgation of guidelines pursuant to this section. It doesn't go to the specific subsection A1, but it says that pursuant to this section. So they're saying the same thing, even though they're not using promulgation literally as a verb there.
Well, actually, that goes in my favor, doesn't it? Because it says pursuant.
I think it's rather neutral.
Well, it says pursuant to this subsection, not just part of this. It says pursuant to this section, which refers to all of 994. If it wanted to say just pursuant to subsection A1, it would have said that.
The guidelines, it sounds like it means guidelines, counsel. That's very hard to get around.
Except that we all refer to guidelines as clearly this is a guideline. 1B1.1 is a guideline. They might term it a policy statement, but it still is a hard and fast rule that has to be followed.
It kept you on your feet a long time past your allotted time, unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant wish rebuttal?
Judge Gentile, I wanted to respond to your question about whether the commission routinely sends out for notice and comment its policy statements. My understanding generally is that they do not, and in this case they did so because Hicks was decided, I think, in January of 2007. This notice came out July 31, 2007. Preceding all of that, back in 2001, we had the Hassan decision out of the Eighth Circuit en banc holding that 1B1.10 didn't authorize a reduction in sentence beyond what the amended guideline would permit. So the commission was A, reacting to that, and B, knew that there would be literally, and there were, tens of thousands of sentence modification applications from people serving sentences for crack cocaine offenses. So that's why they went this route in this unique situation.
But sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do,
yeah.
But it is something that is, in their view, discretionary and at the end of the day not mandated by 994X.
It may to some extent depend upon whether they view what they're doing as legislative or interpretive, because policy statements themselves can be of both those characteristics, although we tend not to review a legislative policy statement because we tend to regard it as unripe if it's really a policy statement. I'm talking about the normal administrative law world, not the sentencing world. The last few lines of 3582C2, court may reduce the term after considering the 3553A factors to the extent they are applicable, if such reduction is consistent with applicable policy statements issued by the Sentencing Commission. Now, I mean, I guess at least one reading of that is that absent affirmative endorsement by the Sentencing Commission in a policy statement, the court is not supposed to look at the 3553A factors.
I think that's right. One has to go through the portal of subset C to find an amendment that does allow for sentence modification, and then one has to calculate what the guidelines as amended would allow. And then if one wants to choose to make that reduction, one can consider 3553A in deciding whether to impose that reduction that's cabined by the amended guideline or not. I think it comes in that order.
You run that by me again?
That 3553A, once one has requested sentence modification based on an amended guideline reduction, and the court has before it the opportunity to reduce someone's range by two base levels of this.
Right.
If the court, and the court is not, of course, compelled to do that, the court can consider 3553A, I believe, in determining whether it wants to go below the original sentencing, whether it wants to actually modify the sentence. I don't think 3553A allows the court to go below that two base level adjustment that comes with the amended guidelines for crack cocaine. At least that's my understanding.
What you're saying?
You're saying that the 3553A factors come in as a step towards simply applying the new range.
I believe that's the case. I believe they don't open the door to go below that.
That's what the Supreme Court said in Dillon.
That they don't open the door to go below that.
Right. In Dillon,
right,
the court said you use the factors within the range. But I think Judge Williams' question is, I think, correct, which is if that clause, if such a reduction is consistent, if that didn't exist, then there would be no authorization to the commission to cut off the limit when the factors could apply, and it could apply below.
Well, yeah, I was suggesting a different possibility,
yeah,
which is that in the absent a affirmative endorsement of use of factors, possibly even selective factors, by the Sentencing Commission, they can't. Well, I guess your argument is they can't go down at all, and I'm adding, at least considering, a potential wrinkle on that. They can't go down beyond what the change of range implies.
I think that's correct. That's my understanding. And to make a final point.
Before you make a final point, what's your answer to defense counsel's argument about guidelines pursuant to subsection A1 as repeatedly stated in the...
Well, the problem with that is that there are numerous other portions of 994 that refer to guidelines and general policy statements together as if they are separate things.
So you think that
which suggests
that Congress just got tired of writing pursuant to A1 every once in a while?
I don't know why they did that, but certainly when putting forward the notice and comment provisions, I don't think they got tired and simply left out policy statements, which would essentially be,
they got tired. They didn't write in subject to pursuant to subsection A1. Why didn't they write that there?
I don't know, but they didn't do it in other sections either. And it's instructive, I think, that the sentencing modification statute itself speaks to policy statements. I think that sort of closes the loop on any uncertainty as to whether that statement is a term of art in this context. And I think Congress meant it to be, which leads to my final point that I don't think the question is governed by APA principles of what's a legislative rule and those sorts of questions, but rather by whether it is a guideline or a policy statement. I think that's the extent of whether notice and comment is required. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call the next case.